like I jumped the desk again. I have screwed up.
That's the very beginning, and then if there are questions about 12 left over from last week, because I didn't take everything that was on the notes, we can come back to that later. Let's make sure that we stay with the schedule first. Okay? So this is the third pivotal chapter. And when we get to the end today, I'll point ahead to a statement in chapter 14, which is the basis of my saying that these are the pivotal chapters, 11, 12, and 13, because they're giving what he calls the basic positions in the philosophy that he's presenting. The basic positions are the positions on knowing, being, and objectivity. So that's why I'm saying that these are the three pivotal chapters in the book. So the third pivotal chapter treats objectivity. It is a complex matter, because there are many different dimensions or many different things that need to be brought into consideration when you're giving a theory of objectivity. The counterposition on objectivity is that objectivity is taking a good look and seeing everything that's there to be seen and nothing that isn't there to be seen. If you stopped the person on the street and said, what is it to be objective, they would come up with something like that. Well, you look and you don't read anything into it. Take everything out of it. It's more complicated. So first of all, it treats the principal notion of objectivity. To reach the notion of objectivity in the principal meaning of the term, something that you've got to have to get the objectivity as it is, Lonergan considers a patterned context of judgments. Patterned context of judgments which serve as implicit definitions of the terms object, subject. That's from 399. We'll see what that means in a minute when we get into number two. So that's the principal notion of objectivity. Objectivity is reached when we make at least three judgments. That's what it means in its principal notion. Okay, but there are partial aspects of objectivity that need to be considered as well. The experiential aspect, it came up in the seminar yesterday for those of you here, because I think the experiential aspect of objectivity is Heidegger's aletheia, and I think there's a lot of work that could be done to integrate those two positions. Okay, letting everything be, letting the given be given. Don't screen it out. Just let it be. Okay, the normative aspect of objectivity and the absolute aspect. So those are the partial aspects. All right, so first of all, then, the principal notion of objectivity is illustrated in these three judgments. This doesn't mean you gotta make these three judgments every time you do it, but I am a knower. This is desk. I am not this desk. Something like that. Or he uses typewriter instead of desk. So there's a first judgment that affirms the existence of some object. Well, I put that second. This is a desk, say A. Secondly, a judgment of self-affirmation. Thirdly, the judgment that I, the self-affirming knower, am not the object A. So in that pattern, the pattern of those three, you can grasp what it means to be objective. Now, immediately, pay attention to my note here. This does not mean that one has to have made an explanatory judgment of self-affirmation in order to be objective, that you can't be objective unless you've read insight. It doesn't mean that at all. It means rather that one comes to articulate the notion of objectivity, to articulate it in a philosophy in dependence on the judgment of self-affirmation, to show it, to show what it means, to give an example of it that's really clear, because we've made that judgment already. I am a knower. If it's also true that this is a desk, and if it's also true that I am not this desk, then there's a subject and an object that are distinct from one another, if those three judgments are true. This one, he would hope that by this time for you it is true. You can affirm that. he would hope, I would hope, we would all agree this is a desk. And I surely hope that we all agree that I'm not that desk. So, and if we've got that, then you've got a subject and an object really distinct in that pattern. That's the only, that pattern shows what it is to have subject, object really distinct, and how you reach the really distinct. It's not by touching the desk. It's not by seeing. I could be hallucinatory, all right? Sight can be illusion. It's true judgment that gives you the that articulates being, all right? And in which later we'll see truth is reached. Truth is reached in judgment. And judgment is made normally at the end of a process of inquiry. So I'm a knower, this is a desk, I'm not the desk. Page 400. The bare essentials of this notion of objectivity, if we are reached, if we add to the judgments already discussed, I am a knower, this is a typewriter, the further judgment that I am not this typewriter. An indefinite number of further objects may be added by making the additional appropriate positive and negative judgments. I'm not that lamp, I'm not that picture, I'm not the birch, I'm not you, all right? And finally, insofar as one can intelligently grasp and reasonably affirm the existence of other knowers besides oneself, like each of you, for instance, then I can add to the list the objects that also are subjects. Okay? I am a knower and Chris is a knower. This is a desk. I'm not this desk, Chris is not this desk. So you can add, but I know someone else who is, I'm affirming, also a subject. Okay? That sort of thing. So you can have a large pattern. But the thing is, you've got to have, to display the notion of objectivity, that's all he's talking about, we need the three. We need the minimum of the three judgments to display it. Now, number three, he lists six properties of this principal notion of objectivity. First, the principal notion, to display it philosophically, it can emerge only within such a patterned context of judgments. Not within any, secondly, not in any single judgment. Okay, you don't get, I am a knower doesn't give it to you yet, because the question will arise, well, what about, are you everything? Okay, because you know everything, does that mean you are everything? And so on and so forth. And so there's further questions to be raised. So, or in the experiential, see, I can touch this, I can see it, I can make a lot of judgments about it, and a carpenter could make a lot more than I can, and sees a lot more than I can see that I wouldn't really notice or pay much attention to. That's the experiential aspect, letting it all be, okay? But it's not found there. The principal notion isn't found there. Or in the normative factors that occur in any cognitional process prior to judgment. Those are partial aspects to this. There has to have been a process that leads up to this judgment, and this judgment, and this judgment. If that process was, if I was attentive, intelligent, and reasonable up to those, then that's the normative aspect of objectivity. We'll see that more. But the principal notion, the normative, it just gives you one judgment at a time. For the principal notion, you need a patterned set of judgments. Fourthly, judgments in this appropriate pattern are common. So people are you know, two people who are let's say one person's trying to help somebody else in a counseling setup, you know, and the second person has got a transference onto the first one. And somehow the therapist has to communicate, well, I am, you are, and I'm not you, and I'm not a function of you. Now, if he says that, or she says that, the client might get angry. So you have to, there are many different, but that's objectivity. And that pattern has to be there, and the therapist has got to be very aware of that and know what's going on, that the transference is being laid on, that the client is making you into their father or their mother or whatever. And they have to do that in order to work through their problems, but the therapist won't get to that. He or she is in real trouble. So they've got to maintain this pattern context. I am, you are. I'm not you, and I'm not a function of your needs and your whatever. That's objectivity. Pattern context. It occurs all the time. It occurs all the time. people do know objects and subjects. And that's all it means. But at the same time, they won't be able to give a lucid account of this knowledge. Most of us tend to think that we're objective if we see everything that there is to be seen, and nothing that isn't there to be seen. So, for instance, in exegesis, Lonergan will talk about the mistaken principle of the empty head. That, in other words, according to some people, you've got to empty your mind of all preconceptions about what is being spoken of in the text before you can understand what somebody else is saying. And he calls that the principle of the empty head. And then you just look at the text. Reading the text is just seeing what's in the text. Well, that doesn't do you anything at all. In fact, what Lonergan says in Method of Theology is the more you already know about what another author is talking about, the better chance you have of understanding that author, rather than emptying your mind of all preconceptions. You've got to test your preconceptions. If you know something, if I know something about the Gospel of John already, and I'm reading a new interpretation of the Gospel of John, I have a better chance of understanding the new exegete's interpretation than if I empty my head of all preconceptions. The author might challenge my preconceptions, that's fine. But the more I know about the Gospel of John, its background, its language, its theology, the better chance I have of understanding what somebody else is saying about it. So it isn't that empty head just looking and seeing what's there. The only thing that's in the text out there is black marks on a white paper. That's all that's out there. Okay. So if I just stare, if you stare at it, it might as well be written in Japanese or some language that I have no knowledge of. Okay. I can stare at it, but I get nothing out of it. If I'm reading it, I'm engaging in Gadamer's terms in a fusion of horizons. And a fusion of horizons is I'm bringing my understanding and my judgment and my background and the total context of my life. It's all operative as I'm reading this. Right? And I'm fusing my horizon with this one. I'm finding meaning and moving on. I'm expanding my horizon, but also perhaps bringing questions to the horizon that's expressed in the book. That's reading a book. It's not emptying your head of everything. So there are a lot of misconceptions about objectivity, that you've got to be empty and all of that. No, that isn't true. You've got to know where you're coming from. But it's not a matter of but basically, for most people, that's more sophisticated than what most people would think of anyway. But it's rather that objectivity is frequently thought of as seeing everything that's there to be seen, not seeing anything that isn't there. And it's a lot more complicated than that. So they will say, most people will say, we'll assume, this is in number 4, that the existence of objects and subjects rests on the experiential aspect of objectivity, so that if you really take a good look at it, you've got it. They will say the typewriter is an object because they see it or feel it. Okay. Now, they do see it, they do feel it, but that's not what makes it an object of human knowledge. What makes it an object of human knowledge is the judgment it is. Because, and he goes on here, on the other hand, they will admit they would not consider the typewriter an object if they knew it to be true, either that there is no typewriter at all, or what they named the typewriter was identical with everything else. So it's in judgment. It's in the judgment that there is a typewriter, that it is known as an object distinct from the subject. It's in the judgment, not in seeing it, not in feeling it, not in touching it, but in judging. That's the only point that he's trying to make. He's not trying to disparage seeing, touching, but rather that's not where truth is reached. Truth is reached in the judgment. And the clear thing would be in the case of hallucinations and illusions. Right? You see something, but then you reach the judgment that it isn't the case. And it's in the judgment then. It's not because you see it, but you know, people can be in high states of excitability and they can, or close to breakdowns or whatever. And a big log, for instance, in a lake can turn into a monster, a snake. And that's the kind of thing that can happen by taking a good look at something. And it's in judgment that you reach the conclusion. That's okay. I was a little bit off base at that point. Okay. So it's in judgment that the truth is reached, not in sight. And hallucinations and illusions are very clear instances of that. That's why when he comes to define the counterposition on objectivity, or on the real, rather, for in the counterposition, he'll say the real is a subdivision of what is already out there now. Meaning, well, what I some of the things that I see already out there now, obviously there can be illusions. I can think that that block, I could have thought that that log was a monster coming out of the ocean or whatever. Okay. So it's subdivision. But then how do you determine which subdivision is the real and which one is the illusion? Not by looking, only by judgment. Avery Dulles met Lonergan at a cocktail party once. He shook his hand and said, "Do you exist?" And Lonergan said, "Well, if I do, you won't know it by taking a good look." you make the judgment, you know. And he was implicitly letting Dulles know that some of Dulles' writings contained the counterposition of objectivity. Because somebody said that, "Do you think he knew what you were really getting at?" He said, "I'm afraid he did." Okay, so next. This notion of objectivity is closely related to the notion of being. Being is what is to be known through the totality of true judgments, like these three and all the others. Each one of these knows being, if they're true. Knows it's an increment in the knowing of being. Objectivity, in its principal sense, is what is known through any set of judgments satisfying a determinate pattern, like this. In brief, there is objectivity. I'm being objective. If there are distinct beings, some of which both know themselves and know others as others. So I am being objective. If there are distinct beings, first of all, and I know myself, at least that I am, I mean, full self-knowledge is something that none of us will ever come to until we see God. But, you know, we make incremental judgments about ourselves as well, but we know at least that we exist, and I'm not you. Start with that. So I know myself, and I know you as other than myself. This leaves you open to the whole Levinas thing and other and so on and so forth. This is where all of that comes in, knowing the other really as other, not as a projection of myself, a projection of my thirst for totality and so on and so forth. Moreover, the notion of being explains why objectivity in its principal sense is to be reached only through a pattern of judgments. So the notion of being becomes determinate only insofar as judgments are made. Prior to judgment, you can think of being, but you don't know it. And any single judgment is but a minute increment, 1, 2, 3, minute increment in the process towards knowing. Again, being is divided from within, divided cognitively, not like a war of being, it doesn't mean that, but divided cognitively. Apart from being, there's nothing. It follows there cannot be a subject that stands outside being and looks at it. If the subject is outside being, the subject is nothing. I'm in being, right? And I'm not standing outside it and looking at it. The subject has to be before he or she can look. And once one is, then one is not outside being, but one is either the whole of it or some part. And if these three judgments are true, then you're not the whole of it. You're just a part of it. Because you're not something else. There's a distinction that's introduced. If one is the whole of it, then one is the sole object. If you know yourself, you know everything. Right? Absolute idealism comes pretty close to that. Hegel thought that when he, at least according to Kojève, Alexander Kojève, whose work, by the way, his lectures on Hegel are at the heart of modern French philosophy, at least according to, for those of you who are interested, Vincent Descombes, D-E-S-C-O-M-B-E-S, modern French philosophy, and is going into some of the French existentialists, but mainly into what has come to be known as post-structuralism and deconstruction. But Kojève's lectures at the Ecole, School of Higher Studies in Paris in the 30s, are very, according to Descombes, extremely influential in setting up the conditions for the emergence of postmodernism and deconstruction and so on. But if De Kohn is right, Hegel really thought that when he put the last period at the end of the Phenomenology of Spirit, history had come to an end. Not his book, history. That's pretty grandiose, you know? because you know, he had summed it all up, and this was the end. And it's like this guy Fujikama, whatever his name was, in the end of history, that big article that made a lot of Princess Fukuyama. Yeah, with the end of history, saying that there will be no further developments, you know, this kind of thing. But he was talking from a political standpoint. Hegel was intellectual, philosophical, and so on and so forth. But since I've summed it all up, it's all over. Now all I got to do is go back and rewrite it from the top down. I've done it from the bottom up. Now I do it from the top down. But that's it. It's complete. Well, no, that's not it. So if he was right, then he's the sole object because he's done all of this. So whatever his book is the sole object. You don't have to know anything else. If one is only a part, then one has to begin by knowing a multiplicity of parts. A is, B is, I am not B. A is not B. And add that one part knows others. I'm A, B is, I'm not B. That sort of thing. Okay? Sixthly, the principal notion of objectivity solves the problem of transcendence. And here, transcendence does not mean going to God. It just means getting beyond yourself. That's all it means here. He's not talking about transcendence in any religious sense. Rather, how does the knower get beyond himself or herself to a known? The question we suggest is misleading. This was the way I learned philosophy in the first place. You got to start out there, or you never get out there. So the first thesis in the epistemology, as I learned it, and one of the teachers, wasn't the one that I had, but would get so excited he was practically a whirling dervish, running around the room and finally grab him onto the table saying it is, and this class at one point yelled out, I believe. But it's the whole thing, he's got to start you out there, or if you start in here, you'll never get out. It's that whole idea of knowing. How do you get beyond yourself to a known? Well, if you start with yourself, you're not going to do that, so you got to start out there, and you get out there by touching it and jumping on it and whatever. The question is misleading. It supposes the knower to know oneself and asks how one can know anything else. Our answer involves two elements. On the one hand, we contend, that should be contend, not content. We contend that while the knower may experience oneself or think about oneself without judging, still one cannot know oneself until one makes the correct affirmation, I am. And then one knows oneself as being and as object. On the other hand, we contend that other judgments are equally possible and reasonable. So I am, you are, and I go through a similar process of reaching both of those judgments. If it's an intelligent and reasonable thing to affirm that you are, and an intelligent and reasonable thing to affirm that I am, and an intelligent and reasonable thing to affirm that I am not you, that's all I have to do. It's not going from in here to out there. It's making three true judgments. It's not an in and an out. It's not a spatial thing. Other judgments are equally possible and reasonable, so that through experience, inquiry, and reflection, there arises knowledge of other objects, both as beings and as being other than the knower. Hence, we place transcendence not in going beyond a known knower, but in heading for being, within which there are positive differences, and among such differences, the difference between object and subject. So it's heading for being, heading for judgment, and that pattern of the three judgments. I am, you are, I am not you. So it's not going from in here to out there, it's rather three true judgments based on experience and external judgment. Inasmuch as such judgments occur, there are, in fact, objectivity and transcendence. Whether or not such judgments are correct is a distinct question to be resolved along the lines reached in the analysis of judgment. But if these three judgments are correct, the transcendent, that problem of how do I know something other than myself is solved. It's three, make three true judgments. I am, you are, I am not you, you've got it. And you can do that over and over and over. Okay, can I pause there? Let's see. Yes, Chris.
So when we talk about positive differences of appropriate being within the universe of being, what about like the, when we talk about the principle that the intellect and act is the intelligible and act,
mm-hmm.
and so that there's no primordial distinction between...
And knowing there isn't.
And knowing there isn't. So that then applies to the unity there that is not a positive difference applies to knowing. I'm just wondering about when we say primordial, then we're not talking about the universe of being, we're talking about as being, we're talking about the knowing mind on its way heading towards being.
That's right. Knowing, not the theorem of knowledge by identity, which is the Aristotelian theorem, which Thomas picks up and Langevin picks up from both of them, is it refers to the level of what I've referred to in my paper from the year yesterday of elemental meaning. And elemental meaning is empirical consciousness and insight. Okay? For that much of the process, there is an identity. This is a very helpful thing because, well, anyway, I'll come back. Let me come back to that in a moment. Because it makes a lot of very existential points, or points about the existential significance of knowledge by identity in the lectures on education. I mean, how it can really make a difference if you make that your own, and so that you're not treating everything instrumentally or whatever, but that you're, you know, first of all, why not adopt an artistic posture towards it all, you know, and just enjoy it. Whereas our age, I think the point Lauren is making is that our age tends to treat everything as distinct and as means to an end, utilitarian, and so on and so forth. So that we treat everything that comes into our sensation as if it were a stoplight.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it has, if it's green, you can go, and if it's red, you have them. And no, that's instrumentalizing it. Knowledge by identity means you start off instrumentalizing nothing. You just let it be, you know? Okay, but...
See, when you say you just let it be...
Yeah.
Like that language...
That's experiential objectivity. That's...
experiential objectivity, but like the principle doesn't apply to being as being.
No,
so I'm just wondering about,
okay.
Like, I find myself,
right,
when
no,
I think about
right.
it, like,
I'm
a language game.
I'm being rhetorical when I say that.
Yeah,
I'm
I
not
understand.
Being philosophical.
Yeah.
But it's adopting the posture of gelassenheit, of releasement, of contemplation.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote once that the imperative be attentive is a contemplative posture. It's a contemplative posture. But first, that experiential objectivity is achieved by the contemplative. You just, you know, and then let the distinctions arise as the questions arise. Right?
So not to beat this horse, but like philosophically then, this contemplative moment, what is the content of that contemplation? It's a unity. But it's not being as being.
No, it's not known as being. It
it's not known as being.
No.
So what
just
is
comes
that?
Into, well, okay, we can take a little bit more of that when we get to experiential objectivity today, but it's the received data.
Yes.
Received data, whatever they might happen to be. So, for instance, before I give a fairly definitive answer to your question, I got to read it. And not answer a question that you're not asking. You know?
I guess what I'm asking is, what is the ontological status of that identity that's involved in contemplation?
The ontological status of it. That
yes.
is reached in judgment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
See?
Which requires that identity.
That's right.
It requires the identity.
Yeah.
The way he lines the whole thing up in the, when he talks about it in Ethnic Theology is that sense and act is the sensible and act. And in insight itself, in insight, in the grasp of an intelligibility, you're one with what you grasp, okay, in insight. And the distinction of subject and object starts to take place when you start to think out your insight so that you can formulate. Then it becomes, all right, then you get distinct from it, and you've got to stand back from it. and so on and so on. And you formulate it in conceptualization, but then the status of that is only determined when you move on to the judgment thing. Is it really true? And then when you know that it's true, you know it is distinct from yourself. So the ontological status of anything, I mean, the ontological status of what you're contemplating is not determined at the level of experiential objectivity. I mean, whether it's yourself or something else, because you might be contemplating your own feelings, mm-hmm. and then it's you that you're contemplating. But you might be contemplating that painting, that's something else, but you know that in judgment. Or maybe you're contemplating the two at the same time. So then you got to say, I am, and I'm feeling this, but that painting is something else. And it might really be saying something else, or at least in the mind of the artist, but this is what it's saying to me. Those are all judgments. Mm-hmm. But you got to, first of all, let it be, and I don't mean be in the, as an object, but you have to, what's the term that I want? Focus is Eugene Gendlin, Lauren loves Gendlin's little book, Focusing. I think Gendlin's focusing is Lauren being attentive. Yes.
I think I need to clarify this a bit more. For a variety of reasons. The one thing is, like before when you mentioned that being attentive is this contemplative stance. I was thinking about that before, and this was in relation to something I watched yesterday on TV. It was a typical cognitive psychology experiment, a memory experiment, and basically in this experiment it was shown that after people went for a walk with a camera attached to their head, and a month later they were asked what they saw, they were ready to swear on their mother's grave that they saw soldiers attacking them and whatnot, when the camera film actually, when they compared with what they had actually seen, it was completely not true. So that made me think that on their part, they absolutely believed that their judgment was correct. When they were asked, scale 1 to 5, how certain are you that you saw a soldier? This woman said, 5, I'm absolutely sure that I saw a soldier. And yet, it was not true. So then it made me think that for a judgment to be correct, it has to be made in the moment, immediately after the person is really attentive. Unless there is the conversion of the person, perhaps on a psychic level, where there is nothing that is influencing how the memory is going to be stored in the person's consciousness. So then it would seem to me that in the contemplative, in the person who is, okay, because this then is the other side of the question. In the person who is a mystic, who has this attentiveness, as you were saying, there is no objectivity. The first thing that collapses is objectivity because there is a oneness. So where does the judgment come in? Where does, you know, because it's becoming a bit confusing.
The mystic doesn't care about judgment. I mean, this is really true. The mystic does not. The mystic just wants to be one with it. That's all. The mystic has a hard time writing about her experiences. That's where the judgments come in. When Teresa was told, ordered by her confessor, to write her experiences, she really didn't want to do it. She said, I can't. And that's where the judgments, she just wanted to experience it. That's all.
But what does that mean then?
What does that mean?
I mean, does it mean that judgment is, Lonergan himself says that judgment is not the final ultimate thing.
He says it's not?
It's judgment is not the final thing. There are other steps.
Decision and so on.
Yes, so it is a completely different plane of experience. Is that what we're saying?
In the mystic, I think what I'm saying is that in the mystic, the objectivity is primarily an experiential objectivity, unless they are asked to teach mysticism or to write their autobiography, whatever. In which case, John of the Cross has two in a lot of his writings. He's got poetry and a theological treatise. In my view, the poetry is far superior to the theological treatise because the theological treatise is a very dry scholastic theology. But he felt he had to do them both. But the poetry is some kind of more elemental at least, articulation of the experience. Okay. And then the theology is a doctrinal, systematic statement with judgments, with understanding and judgments of what it was that he was experiencing. But what he was experiencing was elemental unity with the divine.
And you're saying the experience itself wasn't judgment anyway?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it may very well be that in a mystical experience is the whole, everything's all together. So it's not just the first level. It may very well be that it's the attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible subject who is fully engaged, probably, because if the mystical experience is a foretaste of the beatific vision, then it's everything. That's just there.
But then in normal consciousness, a normal state of consciousness.
Yeah, I'm much more familiar with normal.
Everybody is. Everybody is. But then there is this problem that our memory, I mean, what we're experiencing and we are storing. And once we're understanding what we're experiencing, our experiencing is being stored. That actually happens before. Then how can we be sure that our judgment then will be correct?
Only if all relevant questions have been answered. It's the only way you can be sure. If all relevant questions have been answered. But there is no other. That's the whole trick to this thing. There is no source of objectivity other than authentic subjectivity. Genuine object. I quoted from Method and Theology here in the notes a little bit later on when we get into the normative, where you're anticipating the normative aspect of objectivity here. But genuine, this is a quote from Method and Theology, I think it's page 292. Genuine objectivity is the fruit of authentic subjectivity. There is no other way to reach it. So there's no other way to reach it. And in a lot of cases, you've got to say, well, I'm not really sure about this, but this is why I'm tending to say this is the case. And you're being much more authentic in that. That doesn't mean you never make true judgments. I mean, we do make true judgments.
Yes.
But the more complex the matter is, the more you've got to make sure that all the questions have been raised and answered before you do. Or you narrow your focus to what you are able to make a true judgment about. And you say the rest of this needs further exploration. But the thing about the memory, all of those memories are part of the experiential objectivity, and they would be explained psychologically. They would have to be explained. There is an explanation for them, why they thought they saw soldiers attacking them, when in fact the camera shows that was not the case. Okay, then it's part of what, the memory itself is part of the data at the level of experiential objectivity. And just as dreams are, like the distinction that he makes when he gets to that, we're jumping ahead here, but that's all right because the questions are alive. He'll make the distinction that the physicist is not really going to pay attention to his or her dreams unless the dreams are providing an image for an answer to the question of the physicist. But otherwise, the physicist might be having nightmares, but they might not have anything to do with physics. They might interfere with their work in the physics, those nightmares, the point is the nightmares are not data for the physicist, but they might be data for the physicist therapist to work with. They are data, and they have an explanation, but the explanation is not in physics, it's in depth psychology or whatever. And the same with these memories, they're there. Now, how do we know that, I had the experience just this last week because I know someone I'm dealing with in terms of fundraising. I remember very clearly that this person said something to me in September, and in an email he said that he said something different. And I remember what I said immediately after he said it to me and repeated it to other people. And so they know at least that was how I heard it in September. Now, So one of us is wrong, clearly. And I haven't confronted him on this yet, but one of us is wrong in terms of what did he say? Is he or is he not going to give us some money? But anyway.
I think this is speaking to the audience, yeah, talking about. You have to distinguish experience and meaning of the experience. Kerr talks about this, and T.S. Eliot talks about this. And you can, in some ways, can't you make a judgment on the experience that's distinct from a judgment on the meaning of the experience? So that you, an example of the mystic. The mystic can say with certainty that something happened, but can't necessarily put that into any sort of term that's useful to us. And so that those are distinct things.
And that's what, when he gets into the experiential objectivity section of the chapter, he's saying that it's equally valid, but valid in different ways, or I forget exactly what his words are. And it's only when you move to the second level that you start sorting out the ways in which the experiences might have a certain meaning. Okay? So, for instance, with the physicist who's also having nightmares, the nightmares may have nothing to do with the physicist, but they do have a meaning that can be perhaps unpacked by a psychologist. And that sort of thing.
I thought this was an elemental question. The more I thought about it, the more complicated it gets. When we're talking about an experience, what exactly are we talking about?
Good question.
Because, I mean, an obvious question prompts it. You know, the people who had a camera attached to their heads for a long time.
For a walk.
That's one experience. But reading this book or reading any long novel, you're going to read it, you're going to need whatever sittings we have to get through this book, 30 sittings. Is that the experience of reading Insight, or is that 30 different experiences then that the memory has to hold and try and synthesize in some way, shape, or form?
I think in each case you've got to say what you mean by the term experience, because you can use it validly.
You can use it
both
different ways.
You can use it validly. That's why in the paper, I don't know whether I said it in the paper that we were discussing yesterday, I think I did, that I don't want to call the first level experience, because it's all experience, the whole thing. I want to call it the level of reception of data. Because experience is not just reception of data. You experience yourself understanding. You experience yourself judging. You experience yourself. Experience is consciousness in its totality, you know. So I don't like you that word anymore for just the first level. I want to talk about the first level as reception of data, and then of course I want, as in that paper at least, I want to expand the data beyond what a lot of people think qualifies as data. But I think experience is the whole of consciousness. And dreaming is an experience. But otherwise, you couldn't remember it at all. And for some, dreams are extraordinary. They're elemental, coming up. I think we're not unconscious when we're dreaming. If we were, we wouldn't remember. Jeff?
I wanted to ask, the imagination can produce phantasms,
yeah,
itself. Do those phantasms necessarily have an intelligibility because you've produced them?
There would be some intelligibility, but the intelligibility may not be the intelligibility that you're looking for in raising a question. You may have produced them for reasons that are pathological, you know? And that's what happens in a lot of psychopathological, not I mean psychopath, I mean, that's a whole distinct category that I don't understand, like schizophrenic cases, for instance, where images are produced that are just, they just come out. They have a meaning, but the meaning can only be determined by the psychotherapist, not a good one. And there are a lot of times psychotherapists can do more harm than good. Somebody said, why is it that you spend 7 years in Freudian analysis and you're no better off when you're finished than you were at the beginning? Well, because you had a bad therapist.
Now, does the memory always also, when someone recollects, are they producing a phantasm at that point, and it's a reproduced phantasm that they experience?
So they're claiming. They're claiming that it's reproduced.
But, so, isn't it the case that when the imagination produces phantasms, you're going to use a hermeneutic to evaluate intelligibility, whereas when you evaluate a phantasm produced by memory, it's going to be more about the real than it is about meaning. Like, it seems to me that the imagination produces phantasms which can have nothing other than meaning. So it's not really connected.
Oh, that's true. All right, but when memory is, then you're going to claim that it has something to do with reality. You're going to claim that. Am I right? Am I getting it to your point? While you're talking, I'm thinking of something like what they're calling today repressed memory syndrome, right? Where people, at least, and I think in some cases this is genuine, I'm not sure it's across the board, but some people have been so traumatized by, let's say, sexual abuse that they've totally repressed the memory. And then it comes back and something that this happened to them.
Thank you. Sorry, I'll try to sum up real quick. I think I'm just getting it. The evaluation of phantasms as intelligible, as produced by memory, is going to be more about their connection to the actual event which happened in the past, whereas the evaluation of phantasms as intelligible produced by the imagination is going to be more practical insofar as they have meaning.
That's right. Okay, I would agree with that. That articulation makes sense. One qualification that I would make is with regard to the first ones, and this comes out from what Nadia said, that your evaluation may turn out to be your own. I mean, the camera shows that the memory evaluated as such and such is not what they really saw. And so then there you've got to find out, well, then why this memory? Why are they swearing on the Bible that this is what they saw? And there is an explanation for that, too. It's a psychological. Can we take a break for a moment? Well, are we at that point? Well, it's just at 3 o'clock. And I think a couple of other questions on this before we go.
Just a clarification. Wouldn't any insight into the phantasm, just to expand on Jeff's question, be a hermeneutic? Yeah. Since it's interpretation.
Yeah, but what I think the distinction that Jeff is making is that if it's connected with memory, there's a claim to it that this is the way it was.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
And that's not the case with every
insight
that you interpret. Because every image that you interpret, some images may be actually not backward-looking in memory, but anticipatory. Like there might be an image of something that we can do that hasn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it could happen. Insight, and this is Thomas, and Lonnie makes the point in somewhere soon. Insight into image is infallible. A lot of the problem with our going wrong is that we don't have the images.
Mm-hmm.
Insight grasps the meaning of images, but it's the image that can be the problem in many instances.
How is different that objectivity from otherness?
I know the other as other in an objective judgment, in a judgment in which I'm being objective. I don't know whether that's getting at your question or not. To put it, the simple thing is that if it's true that I am and you are and I am not you, and those three judgments are true, then at least at that point of with regard to our existence, I'm knowing you as other than me. Now, I've got to, granted, as I work on a personal relationship with you, I have to keep that in mind, that you are other, and I have to continue to, and no matter how close we become, you're someone else. You have your own life, and you're not a function of my needs, and so on and so forth. And if I lose that, then I'm no longer relating to you as other. Does that make sense?
Is there any if we define objectivity from the patterned context of judgment,
yeah.
is there any difference between objectivity and otherness?
Otherness is known by being objective, so that's all I would say. I mean, is there any difference between objectivity and otherness? Well, knowing in that pattern, no, there is a difference between, because I am is not, there's no otherness there yet. It's the pattern. Oh, in the pattern context, I am, you are, I am not you. That's otherness, yeah. So I suppose. And you're getting at what he's saying, the way you formulate what he is saying. To be objective is to know the other as other, whether it's another person or whatever. To know yourself and to know something else is not yourself. I'm going to take a pause and then come back and see how best we can handle those partial aspects, because we've dealt with a number of them already in terms of your questions, experiential, normative. Nadia's question is all on normative. The normative, the authentic subjectivity is the only way to get there. I mean, you really have to, with the memories, you know, I mean, what they've got to do in that case is, once they've seen the movie, are they ready to admit that their memory, that something happened that skewed? Then they're being objective. But if they're not, then they're in denial or whatever.
Actually, this was part of an experiment to study a bit more false memory syndrome.
False memory syndrome.
False memory syndrome, repressed memory syndrome.
Yeah.
Which one is which?
Well, that's the question, you know, because I think some are true. I think some are true. But how do you determine that? And with those traumatic experiences, you know, a lot can go, can get, if they were traumatic experiences. And I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say. Anyway, again, data for psychology.
So that can be also objective. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Their experiences were also objective.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the question. Can one person be objective?
That's part of the objective.
Depends on what you're dealing with. I mean, this is where Rege's position, the paper that I mentioned on Rege and Habermas, paper on Habermas and Lonergan is very important, because as you move towards some judgments, you need the community to help you get there. You need other people. You can't do it all by yourself. And that's what Rege makes that point, and that's why I say that I think he makes a genuine contribution to Lonergan's own project, because he's adding something is really essential to the determination of judgment. Some judgments you can reach with the judge, that something happened judgment that he gives you. That you don't need anybody else to tell you. But with others, you may need the help of a lot of people before you get to the truth. You can't do it. Yes.
I agree with you, Ned. It happens a lot in marriages.
You tell the guy that whose wedding I went to last May.
Don't argue.
Just
surrender.
I'm just musing on how I think that the judgment of what's true in the case of Nadia's instance, or what you're reporting, is very much that the camera doesn't lie. I'm just being a little bit perverse in wondering how absolutely wonderful the science of photography and cinema can be, that it is absorbing, you know, out of the corners and all of the rest, that possibly, given what the subject may be about the person and their capacities, but somewhere along the line, I think that that suggests something of
that's true.
The camera has to be absolutely.
No, I agree with you. I was thinking the same thing before.
Yeah.
I agree. Although it's a good thing that we've got the cameras, because,
sure.
I mean, for instance, they should, the police in the city should have cameras,
sure,
in cars, because there have been so many abuses.
Oh, sure. Sure.
And there should be cameras that take pictures of everything. Sure. That's my goal.
But we use the word lens, you know. So what's the lens through which we are seeing this?
That's
and
right.
That
that's
suggests
right. No,
a certain kind of focus in the lens where we speak.
I agree. All right, let's break. Yeah.
10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.